Shalom Heverim. My friends, let me tell you a parable. Once upon a time, an all-powerful monarch sent a written message of paramount importance and benefit to the people for whom it was intended. Upon arrival, the people were gathered together to hear the contents of the impressive dispatch. The one chosen to read the communication began, "Thus saith the king." He got no further. A tall man with a somewhat melancholy face suddenly interrupted with a loud voice, "Don't you believe it, my friends? Don't you believe it? There is no king. He just doesn't exist." Someone shouted rather angrily, "Fool." Once again the letter was commenced, "Thus saith the king." This time, the interruption came from a man who was sitting at the V-like junction of two roads. He was looking rather wistfully up each road, giving the impression that he longed to travel along both, but was equally suspicious of each. An attitude of indecision, as you can imagine, which chained him a perpetual prisoner to the barren and negative spot on which he stood. "How do we know the king doesn't exist?" he interjected, "since we've never been to his kingdom. And for the same reason, how do we know that he does exist? We never can really know, so why listen at all?" Yet again the message was begun, "Thus saith the king." This time, however, the interruption came from one who appeared to be of some considerable standing among the people. "Of course there is a king," he cried. "I can assure you of that. And you need not have his message read at you. Indeed, I doubt very much whether you would understand it if it was read. Fortunately, I can impart its contents to you. So I suggest you keep it unread and just listen solely to me." Although the king's communication was introduced again, many of the people had now moved out of earshot and were surrounding the three interjectors, who had begun quite an altercation among themselves. "Thus saith the king." Suddenly there moved forward a most imposing gentleman, before whom the ranks of the multitude parted with a deference which seemed to hold within it the element of real fear. "Gentlemen," he began, "I assure you that you should read this discourse, or should I say these discourses. You will find them most interesting and not a little instructive." Taking the imposing documents out of the hands of the king's courier who bore them, the same impressive gentleman continued, "As for this courier, I know him well. He began his journey here in very poor circumstances and in an almost ape-like existence. In fact, you wouldn't recognize him for the man he is today. Moreover, his journey has taken him very much longer than you would suspect, and, to be quite frank, he's lost his way quite a few times. Actually, this has been all to the good, because not only has he had a longer time to pick up the ideas he has written in the documents he brings, but he has gotten no small variety of queer notions from the exceedingly strange places to which he has strayed. However, he's quite an ingenious type of person, by no means lacking in originality, because he has himself refined many of the crude concepts he collected, and has made quite a commendable effort at a plausible synthesis, which he has embedded in these resultant discourses, which will, I am confident, commend themselves to you as literary gems of no mean lustre, particularly as he seems to have captured in some measure a fairly acceptable ego projection of a monarch, to whom he attributes the resultant syntheses, although perhaps they are marred a little by an extravagant and somewhat unseemly anthropomorphism. Moreover, his present imposing attire, in which he presents the documents, well becomes the regal atmosphere with which he seeks to surround them, even though, of course, we know, never let it be said we merely guess, that his present regal uniform is really the patchwork product of many periods and peoples. During this weighty and scholarly commendation, the people had begun to melt away. They seemed to have lost interest in the so-called message from the king. To them, now, or to many of them, this wasn't holy writ. It was more in the nature of holy rot. The courier, moved and perturbed by all this tragic folly, which threatened to rob the people of this priceless patrimony from the king, stepped forward, and with intonation possessing all that authority which vested in him so freshly from the throne of the great king, he cried again, "Thus saith the Lord." There were some left who decided wisely to close their ears to all but the words written by the king in the documents. Admittedly, their numbers were fewer, but their light was greater. Do I need to explain this parable that I've just told you? The great king is the eternal God, blessed be he, and the important written message he sends is Kitveh HaKodesh, the Bible. The first interjector is the atheist, who says in his heart, "There is no God." Look up Psalm 14, verse 1. The man at the V roads is the agnostic, whose attitude of negation clothes him with garments of unreality fringed with fear. Then we have the substitutionalist, who, in place of the written revelation of God, sets up mere human opinion and tradition, quite unauthorized by the Bible itself. Then comes the naturalist, so extremely saturated in a pantheistic evolutionism that he is quite convinced that man began as a speck and evolved into a sage. Man is quite a seasoned traveler. Indeed, sometimes you can smell the seasoning. Like a repulsive, bloated spider, the undemonstrated theory of evolution pounces upon every legitimate human concept and, devouring it, assimilates it into its own evolutionary system to spin it out again in a webbed mesh which ensnares, traps, and imprisons all ideas contrary to its own theory. And the victim to the evolutionary spider is to be sucked dry of anything even remotely suggesting or savoring of a divine revelation. There are those, however, by no means lacking in scholarship and in standing, who choose to allow the Bible and the Bible alone to speak for itself. They are willing to listen to it and to give sober consideration to its undeniable claim of being a divine revelation from God to mankind. Maybe these are fewer in number, but very humbly, I suggest that they have the greater light. Call them supernaturalists if you will, though I claim no complete accuracy for the definition. Anyway, in these messages, we approach the Holy Scriptures in a condition of willingness to let them speak for themselves. And this attitude already has brought us some arresting and exciting facets hitherto unsuspected by us. You will remember that we found that the divine accent in Genesis, the first book of the Bible, was not on those ologies of the wonders of creation such as we might have expected. On the contrary, the divine emphasis was rather upon four human beings. In order to trace the supersignificancy of this unexpected feature, we retraced our steps to the garden in Eden, where we discovered both a loss and a legacy. The loss was sin's vicious entry into the human race. The legacy was the divine promise of redemption through the seed of the woman. Since the four super-significant lives of Genesis, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph, are all in the line of the seed of the woman, being descendants of Shem, we now know where and why the divine interest and purpose attaches in human affairs. Our next discovery was a chronological surprise. For again, contrary to our expectation, we found Abraham to have lived at a time, in round figures, 2,000 years after the creation of man, and again in round figures, 2,000 years before the inauguration of the common era. This discovery spurred us on to examine the sevenfold content of the unconditional Abrahamic covenant, as recorded in Genesis chapter 12, verses 1 to 4. And we were convinced of its relationship to and with the Edenic legacy of divine redemption through the seed of the woman. Armed with the observations and recapitulation embedded in this message, I feel we are now well equipped to pursue our fascinating quest into the realms of revelation. Ere I close this message, may I invite your attention to one other chronological factor, which, I am convinced, is evidence of the divine hand upon the ages. Notice the following striking coincidence of age spans. Placing the creation of man, more specifically, at BCE 4141, we find that it is 1,656 years to the Great Flood, 4,430 years from the Great Flood to the unconditional Abrahamic covenant, 430 years again from the covenant to the Exodus from Egypt, and again 1,656 years from the Exodus to the crux of the common era. Admittedly, this is a very strange and arresting pattern of periods. We have now seen the chronological centrality of Abraham and the Abrahamic covenant, and we know we are on the track of something interesting and important. Yivarecha Adonai v'yishmerecha. Ya'er Adonai panav elecha v'hunecha. Yisar Adonai panav elecha. V'yaseim lecha shalom. The Lord bless thee and keep thee. The Lord make his face shine upon thee and be gracious unto thee. The Lord lift up his countenance upon thee and give thee peace. Amen.